The mission is simple, to help high achievers naturally eliminate emotional and physical obstacles so they can optimize their life for higher achievement. Welcome. You have just entered the Genesis Zone. Good day and welcome to another episode of the Genesis Zone Show. This is Dr. Brian Brown. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us. I know there are a million other places you could be and you've chosen to be here with us and we so appreciate it. Never ever take that for granted. Today in our ongoing Wellness Warriors series, we're joined by Maricela Robles. She's an environmental lawyer turned children's author and certified meditation teacher who helps parents effortlessly introduce meditation to their children through bedtime or anytime stories. Her genius as a storyteller lies in writing storybooks like You Don't Need Your Body to Sail a Boat, and Why Does Mommy Always Sleep Sitting Up, that get children asking their parents to meditate instead of the other way around after the very first reading. In addition, Maricela provides parents with all the tools they need to start a meditation practice themselves and get their kids meditating through her website, Meditation Fairy. Maricela lives in Switzerland with her husband and young son. When not writing on her laptop or scribbling ideas on her notepad, you can find Maricela analyzing the newest animated movie with her son or exploring mountain hiking trails. In this Overcomer segment, Maricela will be sharing her experiences in the area of overcoming professional burnout. Welcome, Maricela. How are you? Welcome, Maricela. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm excellent. Thank you so much for having me here. I'm super, super happy and excited to be sharing today.
I'm so excited you're here. Before we dive into the main focus of the interview, I think our audience would love to get to know you just a little bit better. Can you share a little bit about your childhood backstory with our listening audience?
Yes, of course. So even though I'm based in Switzerland right now, I'm originally from Mexico. So born and bred 100%, I grew up there in the city of Monterrey. I don't know if you guys have heard it, not to be confused with Monterrey Bay. And Monterrey is about sort of the third largest city, I think, in Mexico. Wow. You know, several millions of people live there. I don't know. I'd lost count. It's probably about five at the moment. So I grew up there. Lovely childhood, generally speaking. And both of my parents worked, always did, very workaholic. I was shown from a young age that to be good and successful, you had to work really, really hard all of the time. And that probably dictated a big, big part of the decisions that I made that ended up sort of leading me to, you know, to the career that I chose and what I wanted to do, because that's the example that I saw from my parents who, you know, had very little when they started, and they created something very good for themselves through a lot of hard work and determination. Mm-hmm. But just constant. And my dad is now 70, nearly 72, and he still refuses to retire.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. He's like, no, you're not kicking me out. I'm like, okay, Dad. But we had, you know, loving parents, and we had this one, what they did allow themselves was one huge holiday a year. And when I say one huge holiday, it was about 2 weeks. For about 6 years, I think, straight, we ended up going, I remember, to Disney for about 1 week, which, having done it as an adult, I bless my parents to have done that, because my goodness, it's tiring. And then 1 week in the Caribbean, just, at the beach, scuba diving, water sports. I'm a water baby in that sense. So that's for me what I remember mostly.
I hope the Caribbean portion was after Disney.
Yes. Very smart that they did that. So they exhausted themselves
exactly.
at Disney and then were able to recover at the Caribbean. Yeah. And very, you know, forward thinking, they put me and my brother in a fully bilingual school. So my accent at the beginning was very sort of American. And then when I moved to England, became a bit of a mish of both. It's now a bit confused. But yeah, so I was, it's funny because when I came out of high school, I knew more words in English than I did in Spanish.
Wow.
So I would be like, I remember looking, you know, there was a plane going by and I was like, what's that? Avión. I would remember it was quite funny. So yeah, so that was a bit of my background, my childhood, growing up in Mexico.
So was it U.S. English or was it British English school that was
there? No, it was U.S. There were a few. So the teachers that we had, there were a few from the States and a few from Canada as well. And they're just with a random sort of European teacher thrown in there for good measure, who was not British. So yeah, but it was pretty, I mean, if I think about it now with my own son who's going, well, he's doing actually English and German because we're in Switzerland. So when I think about it, it was about, I don't know, 6 hours of English and then 1 hour of Spanish. And obviously the idea is that, you know, I was speaking Spanish anyway with my parents and friends, et cetera. So sort of that 1 hour of Spanish was very focused on the grammar and, you know, things like that. So I was there till I was about 23, I think. And then I said, I'm going to do a master's degree abroad in England for 1 year. And I'm still in that year. that was 17 years ago.
That's great. And you only spent 1 year in the UK?
No, so I went, after that, then I, and this is part of, I guess, I was very adamant that I wanted to do, that I wanted to study abroad. And I had told my parents, and this is all I had it from since high school. I said, when I finish my degree, I want to do a master's degree abroad and I'm going to pay for it myself. So you guys, you know, you don't have to worry. And then I graduated and I was like, I'm stupid. How am I going to pay this myself? Like how, you know, I've just graduated. I'm not making any money really.
And
I landed a job that was sort of commission based. And so I ended up making quite a lot of money for a 23-year-old just out of, you know, of law school. Because it's not like in the US where you come out with a law degree and if you land a big job in a big law firm, then you're set. It doesn't quite work like that. So I went for my degree for a master's in the UK. And then from there, I thought, I really need to learn French. And as you do, right? And I decided to go to Paris for a few months. And I had run out of money at that time. And my parents very nicely, they said, look, we'll support you for 4 months. And then at the end of that, either you come back or you have to find yourself a job and find yourself to support yourself. I was like, okay. So I went with nothing, no idea. And then I found this job opportunity in Amsterdam. And so I was like, well, why not? Let's go to Amsterdam. And so I went to Amsterdam and I lived there for about 2.5 years, nearly 3 years. And then from there, they asked me to open up the office in London. And so then I went to London and then I stayed in London for about 12 years after that. And then about three years ago, then we decided, you know, after Brexit and all of that situation, that's a whole other conversation that we will not get into. Then we decided to move to Switzerland. And we were in a good place and I've loved it. It's really great. It's quite a difference from London, but beautiful and fun and amazing in its own way as well.
That's a great story. So sounds like necessity was truly the mother of invention because you were given a 4-month ultimatum and you figured it out quickly.
I was like, do I want to stay or do I want to go? And I was having way too much fun to have gone back. So yeah, that's I made great. It work.
So for those listening in the listening audience, our overcomer segment, we focus on exceptional people who've overcome obstacles and live to tell about it. Marcella, could you share with us the details of one or more obstacles that you overcame in the course of your either childhood or your young adult years, or adult years for that matter, in the course of your life?
Yes, of course. So, I mean, for me, I think there's been obviously, depending on the context, one looks back and you think, at the time you were sort of thinking this is the end of the world. And then you look back and you're like, that wasn't the end of the world, really. Mm. I shouldn't have been looking at it in that perspective. Yeah. Whereas others, you do think, oh gosh, I struggled with that and I was able to sort of, overcome it, as it were. And I think for me, there were two points probably that I do remember very strongly, have shaped in one way or another, the person that I am today. And one of them happened when I was younger, when I was still in university and I was about 19, and I had, my first relationship, and it was a very toxic relationship. One would say, sort of teenager and, whatever and this and that, but it was very possessive, very sort of not physically abusive, but very sort of mentally abusive. Now I recognize that was happening. Lots of jealousy. I wasn't, didn't want me to see my friends. He couldn't go out sort of without, couldn't go out sort of without him, couldn't this, couldn't that. And that ended up with me really developing. I was such a sort of free spirit and such, I had lots of friends and very outgoing, and I became this really sort of retreated into myself, this person that just didn't want to talk to anybody or be with anybody anymore except this person that I was with. And it's really interesting, the advice, quote unquote, that you get from people. I remember sort of, my mom, bless her, she said, if you really love him, like, you guys, don't seem very well suited. But she said, look, you have two options. You either give in and just flow with the current and basically change everything about yourself to be able to fit in that relationship, or you fight against it, and then you're always going to be fighting against it, and then sort of it's going to be a nightmare.
Great advice. Right?
And for me, I was like, and what ended up happening through a bunch of, mental, also, let's say, mental abuse, I guess, in that sense, I developed depression. Luckily, my mom recognized it. She was able to then take me to somebody who would help me, because I wouldn't have, I didn't know. I just sort of retreated. And luckily she was able to sort of bring me out of it and take me to somebody who was able to help, and who, through therapy, we worked together and were able to deal with that. And what I realized at the moment is that I needed to extricate myself from that relationship completely. And at the time, I figured that the easiest way to do that was just to leave the country, effectively. Mm. And so I decided, things appeared as they do sometimes. And I think once we make a decision, sort of things just happen, and these opportunities start appearing that you hadn't seen when you were there. And the moment I made that decision, like literally the next day, I was talking with a friend and he's like, I'm going over to do an exchange program in Maastricht in Holland. And I was like, I need to go there. I was like, I don't care what it is. I need to do that. Mm-hmm. And it took a lot of me to, because I was still in the throes of that relationship, in the very, if you remember, the teenage sort of love, as it were. And it was very difficult for me to make the decision, but I was like, no, I need to do this. And that me leaving was the catalyst for that then changed sort of a lot of things about myself and what I realized and how I viewed life, and working on becoming more aware and more conscious of the situations that I had let myself into and recognizing that and deciding that I wasn't going to let, you know, somebody else dictate what I could and couldn't do, and that any partner that I had had to be fully supportive of what I wanted to in my life without any restrictions.
Right.
And that really, I mean, I have a wonderful husband who I love, who is exactly that. I got very clear, and I think you may have heard this before. A lot of people say, you know, one of your biggest decisions is not what you're going to study, but actually who's going to be your life partner, you know, or who you're going to marry. Mm. Because that, I believe that that relationship is so strong in terms of steering you in a good or bad direction of life, that actually, that can define your success in a way. And so that for me was one of the things sort of recognizing, which then when we're coming to the next part of you know, when I had my burnout effectively, because I had had that experience, because I knew what it felt like, the second time around, it was like I was staring into the abyss and I knew where it was leading. And I was on my own in a foreign country. You know, I had a little one to look after, you know, my husband, super supportive and loving, but who had no idea about how to deal with it, who had no idea about how to deal with any of this. I didn't have mom. I didn't. So, but because of that experience, I was able to make a decision to say, wait, actually, I am not in a good place to make any decisions now, any big sort of life decisions, which I think is a big thing about what happens. People in you know, in the throes of anxiety or depression, they end up making really, really strong life-changing decisions that they end up regretting bitterly when their mind is clear. And because it's like a fog, you have a fog in front of you and you can't see. And all you want to do is just run away and leave everything behind, because you think once you run past the fog, things will get better. But the problem is just keep running into the fog and it just keeps going with you. Right.
Well, it's like the advice your mom gave. I didn't finish my thought. I said great advice, but it's great advice, but it's great advice if you want to live in fear. You know, yes. If you choose to live in fear and stay where you are, you know, your mom gave you two ultimatums and neither one of them were really, really good. And it sounds like the same thing that you ran into professionally years later, that with the burnout, it's like,
yes,
I can either stay here and give in, or I can stay here and fight it and be miserable. Mm. And your third option that you learned through that experience was I can leave. Stay here. Yeah.
Exactly. I can leave. And I think there's a big difference between, between people thinking you're running away from something and you're running away from a problem, to actually separating yourself and giving yourself distance from the person, from the issue, from whatever it is that you need, because sometimes you need that distance for the fog to clear.
That's a good word.
Before you are able to see what it is that's in front of you and what you have to deal with. And, you know, my mom, she was able to recognize that, I guess, because she also had a sort of similar decision. And for her, those were her two options, right? And so I look at it now and I think, she could have said, look, you don't have to stay. Like, you don't have to. You know, you don't have to do this. Sort of, this is not a good relationship for you. This is not, would I have hurt her? I don't know. Sometimes when we're in that depth of denial and sadness and fear and, you know, physical and emotional fear, we sometimes don't listen. And that's also where, you know, lots of friendships end, because people feel like, you're not understanding me. And, you know, they go away, even though they can see it clearly because they're not in it.
Right.
But yeah, I think those were for me two biggest decisive, let's say, obstacles or factors that I can remember that mentally and physically took a toll on me in that respect, that I was able to, okay, I'm going to get this over. I'm still going to ace my test in university. I'm not going to let, you know, that was something that I also had. Like, I was like, I'm not letting a man sort of ruin my chances. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So in some way, I still had that sort of strong, you know, sense of like, no, this is my stuff. So even if I'm crying and through my studies, I'm still going to study and ace this exam. So that little part of me was always there, thankfully.
Right.
Because otherwise it would have sucked.
So, you know, you talked through the relationship and the lesson that you learned there, and you touched on the burnout, the professional burnout years later, and how you used that first example to kind of work through that. What did you find to be most helpful in the professional burnout situation to help you navigate through it, other than the tools that you had picked up from that previous situation?
Well, the burnout, the professional burnout was like, you know, it almost felt like the other depression was like a mini, almost like a baby depression compared to what happens with the burnout. Because it came with much heavier physical representations of, it wasn't only sort of sadness or depression or tiredness. It was actually, it ended up with vestibular migraines. And I don't know if you know what vestibular migraines are. You probably do. Yeah. But for your audience, they're effectively, so instead of just getting this really bad headaches, you are dizzy all the time, and then you get vertigo.
Right.
And being dizzy all the time means, like, it's as if you got off a boat where you're sort of, oh, I can't walk properly.
Right.
And then I couldn't, you know, I had to hold things. I couldn't drive anymore because it was dangerous.
Yeah. It pretty much means you're laying flat on your back through the migraine.
Exactly. Yeah. But exactly. And if I wanted to get on the tube, sort of the underground, when I was in London, I would throw up because I was already dizzy, and you add more movement and then it just made me sick. So I couldn't get on the tube. It was just so limiting physically that it just made me realize, like, oh, okay. Now I need to properly listen. I think what I was able to carry on from the first, from my first experience was the, you know, because when it started, I was so sad and so depressed, and yet I had everything. You know, I had a baby boy who was healthy, who I adored. I had the job that I had worked for years. You know, I was at a top law firm in London, sort of with, you know, my office on like the 25th floor, enjoying amazing views of the city. And I had a wonderful husband who loved me and supported my career and looked after our child. And we shared sort of, you know, the home, you know, taking care of our home and our child in the same way. And yet I was so, so, so sad and so depressed that all I could think about was, everybody is better off without me. You know, I just want to leave.
Very hopeless.
Exactly. Very, very hopeless. And I think I can understand when people are in that situation that they leave marriages, and they leave their families because you feel so, such in despair that you don't know what to do. And you love them, but you don't want to hurt them. And the last thing that you want to do is stay there and sort of cause a problem. And for me, the presence of mind of, you know, I got to that point where I was like, I just no longer want to be here. But it was remembering, wait, this is the abyss. This is the top, you know, you're at the edge. And if you make this big decision now with the fog, not knowing what's happening, not having a clear mind, you're going to regret it. So as much at that moment as I wanted to just get up and go, which I've seen over and over and again, I've seen so many people do. And then once they afterwards, after a year, they're like, I really shouldn't have done that. I mean, for me, I'm so grateful that I had that first, experience to stop me, to stop me from running away from my family, from running away from, you know, my marriage, and to be able to just stay there and say, okay, this is my issue.
Right.
How am I going to deal with it? And how am I going to get through it? Because either alone or with them, this is still going to go on.
Just for perspective's sake, how long did you kind of sit in that that dysphoria, that depression? How long did that last?
It was about a year and a half.
And the migraines occurred over that year and a half as well?
Then longer.
Oh, wow.
That took longer. That was about, that was about a year added to that.
Wow.
Because that's how the body works, right? So it was first the depression, tiredness, exhaustion. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't stop. I still was working. I was still, you know, at the office, nobody would know. How, like, you're a lawyer at an office. Like, who's going to want to, you know, you don't talk about that. It was.
So nobody knew that you were struggling with migraines.
Nobody knew.
Wow.
And, nobody knew I was struggling with depression. And then once with the migraines, then that's when I had to tell them. I was like, I need to work from home.
Right.
It's like, I can't, you know, I'm having these migraines. I can't. And then at that point, after several months, because it starts little, it starts small. It doesn't start to do.
It always does, doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It starts small. And so my body was like, okay, depression. Okay. Now you're tired. I should have stopped there. I didn't. I kept on going. And then, okay, like a little bit, oh, I'm feeling, you know, I'm feeling a bit dizzy. I'm feeling that. I just kept on going. And it was once I got hit by vertigo, I think not only by vertigo, but I think I remember my mouth, I lost feeling around my mouth. There was numbness around my mouth.
Right.
And at that moment was when I was like, maybe I should see a doctor. It was so then.
Out of curiosity, how long did it take before you knew that this was burnout related, that this was stress related? Did you know immediately? I know it's easy in retrospect to look back and say, oh, I knew almost immediately. But in the moment, how long did it take you to realize that, gosh, this job is killing me?
It was, so once they identified and they said, okay, you have migraines, you have vestibular migraines, then they said, you need to now find out your triggers. And it was in that exploration of the triggers, which they were like, you need to cut out cheese and you need to cut out wine and you need to cut out chocolate. And I was like, I better stop at chocolate. I'm not stopping chocolate. But it was all through that, and they didn't go away. I stopped everything. I then kept introducing. I did this. I did that. I just kept going and going and going and going, and it didn't go away. And I remember, I said, I need to exercise. I need to do something. And I started going to a HIIT class, which is probably the worst thing that you should do when you're having sort of vestibular migraines.
When you have vestibular migraines.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So I was like, I don't care. I'm going to this HIIT class. And during the HIIT class, I was fine. Like, I was able to jump. I was able to exercise. It was those 45 minutes. I was so focused and so engrossed and so forgetting about everything else. And then I would finish and then it would start again.
Wow.
And that is
so important. And for those who don't know, when she says a HIIT class, she's talking about high intensity interval training. And it's very intense. But the research shows, as I've talked about on previous podcast episodes, is that exercise actually decreases stress. It decreases anxiety. It increases endorphins, your natural painkillers, and it increases your serotonin, your mood-enhancing neurochemicals. And sounds like, Maricela, that's exactly what was happening. You kind of surprised yourself, it sounds like.
Exactly. And the only reason why I started sort of the HIIT class, actually, was because at that point, when they said, okay, you have vestibular migraines and all of that, the doctor gave me something, gave me a pill that made me feel awful. Uh-huh. And I was like, I can't take this. Right. Like, I got pain on my back and my hips and my legs. And the moment I stopped it, it all went away. And he's like,
yeah, it's not that you can't take it. It's like, I can't live this way.
Yeah, exactly. And so I was like, no, I can't do that. And he's like, well, and then his answer was, well, if you can't take that, then you're going to have to learn to live with it. And I was like, excuse me? I was like, what do you mean to learn to live with it? And he recommended this lady who was a vestibular migraine specialist, and it was a sort of rehabilitation. And I started going to see her. And I mean, and I'm going to tell you this, this is going to sound crazy, but this is literally my first session with her. We got in, I was sitting down, and obviously I'm like feeling like I'm going sideways, right? And she says, okay, you know, we start chatting a bit. And then she says, okay, now get up. And I was like, okay, I get up. And she's like, okay, stand on one foot and then the other, and then one foot and then the other. So I'm there standing, lifting one foot, lifting the other, lifting one foot, lifting the other. And then she's like, okay, now I want you to tell me all of the fruits and vegetables that you know, and you can't repeat them. I was like, okay, I don't know what this has to do with vestibular migraines, but fine. And I started doing that, you know, and I was like, okay, apple, and then, you know, melon, and then da-da-da, and this and that. And, oh my God, by about, I don't know, maybe 1 or 2 minutes, I just stopped, and I sort of, I put my head down, and she looked at me, and she's like, okay, sit down. And I just started crying and crying and crying and crying. And she's like, how do you feel? She's like, how does it feel? And I was like, I just wanted you to stop. Like, stop harassing me about flipping vegetables and fruits and fruits. And she's like, okay, good. She's like, what you just did there was effectively like a forced representation of what happens to you when you're under stress. Mm. She's like, you're having to balance. So you're having to physically balance your body. You're having to recall memories of things that you know, and you have to calculate at the same time what you've said and what you haven't said. Mm. And all of that is stress. Mm. Your body is under stress. And when we started working together, I was like, that's my trigger. Mm. My trigger is stress. And that together with the HIIT sessions, where, because she was very encouraging, she's like, look, to get over this, like, you have to put yourself in uncomfortable situations, and you have to do things, you know, you can't just stay at home sitting down. It's like that you're never going to get out of it if you just stay at home sitting down.
Right.
And so that's how I ended up with the HIIT sessions and realizing that during the HIIT sessions, I just didn't have any of these symptoms. But once I finished, they came back. And that is what put me on the journey, because I was like, I need to figure out a way to make this stop permanently. Mm-hmm. I cannot have a quick fix. I cannot have, because it was like having a shot of whatever, right? That it made me feel good for an hour.
Right.
And then you go back to your normal self. And that's how I ended up then finding meditation and everything that happened after that.
Yeah, I mean, you pull yourself out of the stress for an hour, and then boom, you put yourself right back into it.
Yeah, because mentally I didn't change anything, mm-hmm. right? And it's what happens as well when people say, oh yeah, I practice meditation, and you sit yourself for half an hour, 15 minutes or an hour, whatever it is long, and then you go back to being a, you know, crazy person. Mm-hmm. You can't outdo 23 hours of craziness with 1 hour. You can't.
Then, you know, that's worth repeating. You can't outdo 23 hours of craziness in 1 hour. It's so true. And I think everybody has this tendency to think that they can. Mm. So that's an excellent piece of advice there, is you really can't outdo 23 hours of craziness. Something has to change on a grander scale.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that for me was, you know, I continued with my, you know, HIIT lessons, and I continued seeing this therapist who was amazing. Mm. And eventually the exercises became more complex and weird. Mm. Like, I remember getting back home and my husband would be like, oh, what was your session today? And I was like, she made me stare at a giant rotating white thing with dark spots. And he's like, okay.
It's like, I think she's trying to make me have a seizure here.
Exactly. And actually, funnily enough, what she explained was that is a similar training that pilots go through. Mm. So it's like, it was this huge sort of really a round thing that just would go round and round and round and had all of the spots. And then she would turn off the lights and they would glow. And so the whole point was to make me dizzy in a sense. And for me, she said, you need to trust the rest of your body. And I think this was really, really insightful and important at the time. She said, you're only trusting your eyes at the moment. And your eyes are telling you that you're dizzy because, or that you're not, you know, that you should be dizzy because you can't, you know, everything is moving around you. It's like, you need to trust the rest of your body. You're sitting down. You're not moving. You're not going to fall. Your ears, your everything else. And for pilots, that's what they do. They say they need to trust everything and not just what their eyes are seeing, because a lot of the times they can't see anything.
Right.
And so that for me was like, wow. Okay, I hadn't thought about that. I hadn't thought about how all of my body needs to work together for me to be okay, right? You can't trust one part or the other; otherwise, it's just not going to work.
Right.
And all of that, yeah. Eventually, you know, then they just went away. Once I started meditating, once I started everything, and I haven't had a migraine since then.
So had you in that process when they went away, had you already quit work or were you still working?
No. So I changed. So I had changed from the law firm. I decided I need to change. I'm going to go in house because I thought that would be less stressful, which in a way it sort of was. And it gave me more flexibility. I was able to work from home more in that sense. But it was for an American company. So it was very sort of, you know, it was very driven and very like, you have to perform and you have to do this and you have to do that.
Right.
But it was more, I think, for me, the realization that came together of, you know, all I wanted to do, like my mom tells me this, that apparently when I was five, I was watching one of these shows, which would have been an American show, I'm sure. Because we don't have that in Mexico, where, you know, it was the court and the judge and the two lawyers were there, right? And I don't know what it was about. And I was like, Mom, that sounds really age inappropriate for a 5-year-old. but she said that I turned around and I said, Mommy, that's who I want to be when I grow up. And so I had this thing about, I want to be a lawyer when I grow up. And then I had, you know, this thing sort of, drawings, please save the planet, I had when I was like 8. And so that's where the environmental sort of part came up. And so all of my life I was working to become this, to become a lawyer, an environmental lawyer, to prove myself, to show everyone that it didn't matter that I wasn't, you know, that I was Mexican and that I was a woman, that I could do the same, if not better, as anybody else. And all of the Oxford, Cambridge educated kids that were competing for places. I could do it, right?
Right.
I could do it, right?
Right.
And
right.
So I think the moment that I left the law firm, I knew that I didn't want to be a lawyer anymore, that I didn't want to have that life anymore, but I was not yet willing to accept it. And that caused enormous internal conflict for me because I had been so defined by being a lawyer and what that meant, you know, in whatever context, prestige or not, or whatever, that letting it go was really, really difficult. And I think it was only really when we moved to Switzerland 3 years ago when I was like, okay, I'm ready now. Like, I want to let it go. And it was a conscious decision of me saying, I'm going to quit my job and then we're going to move and then I'm going to figure it out. And I'm going to see what's going to happen.
But I think the beautiful piece of that story is that you'd already moved into that place of healing. And healing occurs in stages. But as far as from a physical sense, the vestibular migraines were gone, correct?
By that time, I think yes. By the time we moved here, I think that I wasn't dizzy anymore. So I was in a much better place. But they weren't fully gone until I started my meditation practice.
I was going to say, regularly. Where did meditation come into this? Because I know That's your expertise. So
yeah,
let's talk about that a minute.
So when we moved here, and I was still, I was still going through certain things, because sometimes other things happen that then throw you for a tailspin that you right. weren't really expecting. So I don't think I've shared this before publicly, before we moved, I was pregnant. And then sort of the week or 2 weeks before we moved, I had a miscarriage.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. And I hit that like it's like the automatic response in me kicked in. The lawyer persona that I was trying to leave behind kicked in. Mm. I just need to get through this. We're moving. You know, it's fine. I'm going to put it aside.
Right.
Which was a mistake. Obviously, I didn't give myself time to grieve. I didn't give myself time to heal physically and emotionally. And when we moved here, I was still in this really weird mental space and physical space. And that's when I remember my brother, actually, he said, there's this guy that I think you should go and see. He's going to be, he's going to be in Basel speaking. And, he's like, I don't know how far away you're from Basel, but you need to go. Mm-hmm. And it was, and I don't know if you know him, your audience maybe knows as well, is Dr. Joe Dispenza.
I've heard the name.
Yeah. And so I was like, okay, my brother never tells me random things to do. So I should listen. And so I went I had tried meditation in the past when I was in London. I remember I used to go to, it was like a Tibetan sort of group meeting where you would do group meditations, and there were a lot of chanting and mantras and also silent meditations. But I never really stuck. I went there once a week but I wouldn't practice it. Like I didn't know how to, or I didn't know what to do sort of, or anything. So it didn't really stuck. And when I heard him speak, who uses a lot of, science-based and evidence-based information on meditation, that's when I was like, okay, this interests me now. Okay, I want more of this. And talking with my brother and seeing the changes that he had in his life and his wife had in his life, who was a completely different person, I said, okay, I'm going to start meditating every day for at least, 45 minutes, no matter what, Sunday, Saturday, it doesn't matter. Every day I'm going to wake up and I'm going to do it. And I decided I'm going to do that for a year and then see what happens. And I remember before that sort of my brother, he was like, oh, you really need to get into this and do it. And I was like, typical, I don't have time. And, he's like, I said, I have a child. You don't. And you don't know how it is. And he's like, well, what time does he wake up? And I said, 6. And he's like, well, wake up at 5 then. And I was like, offended. What do you mean? Wake up at 5. But I was like, you know what? You're right.
That's almost as bad as taking away chocolate.
Exactly. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to wake up at 5. And I'm just going to see what happens. And his most convincing point, I have to give it to him, was like, look, you're going to wake up, sit down, and then close your eyes again. So it's really like you're sleeping. And I was like, okay, maybe, maybe you have a point. So I started that. And then after about 2 months, I started feeling massive, massive changes. Mm. And I was like, right, I want to go to a retreat. And so I went to a retreat, a 1 week retreat, which was amazing. And then after that, then obviously the whole sort of meditation, I started writing books for my son and everything that happened then. And then I decided to, okay, I want to learn more. And I decided to become a meditation teacher and all of that. And now everything is just so different, for me. And that has changed massively. And I still, I still meditate every day. And if I miss 1 or 2 days, like I think the most that I've been without meditating since I started has been like 4 days. And I was like, I could start feeling myself again. And I was like, why am I doing this to myself? Just sit down, you know, and do it. And sit down, you know, and do it. And that to me is, that just changed completely everything. So that's where all of that started.
That's great. So if just kind of recapping, you know, through your journey, you found out that high intensity interval exercise helped short term, but it helped. The right therapy, very, very targeted therapy to work through the vestibular migraines helped. And then meditation was kind of what sealed the deal, so to speak. And that's the one that's been ongoing and long term. Is that correct?
Yes. So I think meditation was, remember, to the 23 hours, right? You can't do. So I was doing the 1 hour trying to compensate for the other 23. Right. Meditation helped me sort out the other 23.
Well, so it's like a magnifier.
Yes, because you then become, what it gives you really is awareness and consciousness about what you're doing and why and how you're reacting to it and the emotions and the thoughts and the triggers.
Right.
And if you don't have that awareness, you're not going to be able to get off this crazy wheel.
Right.
Because for you in your mind, you're right and everybody else is wrong.
Right.
You know, it's their fault. They're the ones being mean to me. Mm. So they are making me feel bad. So they are angering me. Mm. You know, my son's meltdown is making me sort of uncomfortable. It's his fault. When really it's all us.
Right.
If you start thinking about each and everything, it's like, no, it's you.
Right.
You are the one who you can control. You can control. So you are the common denominator in all of those interactions.
Right.
And so you need to figure out how you are going to decide what you think and what you do and how you react. And it's when you do that with, you know, with curiosity and a bit of also humility, trying to sort of accepting that, look, you don't know everything. Mm. You're probably wrong about a lot of things. And you know, and that's when things start changing and where you can get away from that craziness and not let yourself fall prey into that. And so you find the one thing that works for you, and that may be HIIT or that may be, you know, even if I was only doing a 1 hour meditation and then again, the 23 hours, you have to still work on that awareness and that consciousness for the rest of the day. You can't just rely on those 20 minutes or 45 minutes that you do to be able to lift you out of whatever it is that you want to be lifted out or to take you to whatever it is that you want to take yourself.
Mm-hmm. That's good advice. Great advice. Related to overcoming burnout, are there any other last nuggets that are pieces of advice that you want to share?
Yes, I think so. I made a decision when I was, you know, when I was feeling really, really ill, and I just decided I was going to talk about it, and I was going to tell, you know, actually, I didn't tell my boss. I told my boss's boss at the time. Because I had sort of told my boss in a way and at the time, she said, are you sure you just don't want to take a few days off? Cause I said, I need to take time off. I need to take, and I think I took about a month off in the end. And she's like, oh, you know, you should just take it as holiday. And I was like, you know, and I know in the States it might work a bit differently, but I mean, in the UK at the time, you are really protected in terms of sort of illness or sort of taking time off and all of that is really respected.
Right.
And I could have very easily gone like, oh yeah, you know, I should just take a few days off or a week or take it as holiday. I don't want to impose on them. You know, I don't want to hurt them. But I was like, you know what? No. I need to make this decision for myself. I need to put myself first now, because at any moment, you know, when you're working for a company, and that's just the reality of it, whoever you're working for, at any time, they can just say thank you and goodbye. Say thank you and goodbye.
Right.
Right. At any time. And so for me at that moment, I was like, well, you know, and I had lived through that. Actually, the first law firm that I worked for had basically crashed and burned when I was on my honeymoon that I had fought to take time off for, when the partner at that time had told me, no, you shouldn't take so much time off. And I was like, thank goodness I took the time off, because when I came back, they didn't exist anymore.
When you came back, there was nothing there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that sort of learning, you know, that lesson served me well as well here, because I was like, well, no, I need to take this time off for myself. And I was really afraid about what that could mean. And I know for a lot of people, you know, you can be really concerned about whether you will have a job afterwards coming back to it. But for me, it was so bad. It was so bad that I was like, it's not worth it. I can find another job. I can find something else. So it was honoring that space that I needed to take. And so if you are in the, I think things have changed. I mean, this happened, you know, quite a few years ago. And I think over the last few years, it's become better. The whole, you know, the talk and the conversation around mental health, right. I think it's far more open and accepted. But if you are in that moment where you're not sure about, should I do it? Should I say it? Should I take that time off? You need to take toll of, okay, how important, you know, am I to me? Is my wellness to me? Because, and that's another nugget from my mom, as she once said, she said, look, you can have everything in the world, but if your mind is not right, you don't have anything.
Right.
And that is true, because if, you know, it doesn't matter if you're technically healthy, quote unquote, if your mind is all over the place, if you can't concentrate, if you can't focus, then you can't work, you can't do anything.
Right.
And you need to sort that out first, and then everything else.
How much is your sanity worth?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. There's always going to be another job. Always. And it might not be what you thought you wanted, but it might be what you needed at the time. Right. And so don't be afraid to lose something just because it's familiar and you know it. You know, there might be something better or the same that is uncertain at the moment, and hence it makes you feel uncomfortable because it's unknown. But don't stay something out of fear of familiarity and what will happen. And I recognize that not everybody might be in that position. If you're the breadwinner and the family is relying on you. But at either way, at some point, it's either that or, you know, things can get worse. Because that's what leads people to suicide. That's what leads people to, you know, accidents and et cetera. And you don't want to get there.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great piece of advice and a good way to kind of wrap this up. I love ending the show with a fun question. So bear with me on this.
Exciting.
What would you do if you could be invisible for a day?
That's so much fun. I know. What could I do if I could be invisible for a day? Oh my goodness. I would probably go and eavesdrop on really important people, shadow them through the day and see what they're doing.
See what they're saying.
But you know, this probably has to do, because we sometimes think that things are so much better for others in, you know, oh, if I only had that job, if I only worked for that company, if I only, you know, had that, then my life would be better. Then I would be good. But if we could really be a little, you know, a fly on the wall, we would realize that actually things are not quite what we think they are, and it makes you appreciate a lot more what you have and where you are. I think in that sense, probably to try. I mean, that, and can I still eat if I'm invisible? Because I would then just go into the Lindt factory and just eat all the chocolate first.
That's great. I mean, there's still consequences to being invisible and eating, but sure, you can eat.
Well, that's my decision.
There you go. Awesome. I just love your story of overcoming, professional burnout. Thank you for sharing your insights and your wisdom from your experiences. There are plenty of high achievers out there who've either dealt with burnout or are currently dealing with burnout to some degree, and they're afraid to step out into the unknown. And I think you laid out a really solid, some easy steps people can take to overcome that. And I appreciate that. Thank you. It was an honor to have you on the show today.
No, you're welcome. It was really my pleasure. And I hope, this goes to the ears of somebody who needs to hear it.
I know it will. I'm banking on it. There's someone out there that needs to hear this, and they're going to benefit from it greatly. I can assure you of that.
Thank you.
As we wrap up, I'd like to make our listeners aware of something new. I recently launched my brand new Gene Hack Bootcamp, and it's getting rave reviews. And that means I'm going to be doing another bootcamp soon. In the Gene Hack Bootcamp, using my proprietary Genesis Zone method, I teach you how to know exactly which of your five zones are creating lower physical, emotional, and mental performance for you. And I show you exactly which genes need to be checked within each of those zones in order to propel you to higher levels of physical, mental, and emotional performance. So if you want to be put on an early registration list for the next bootcamp, go to drbriangbrown.com, brianggbrown.com/genehack, GeneHack, and we'll get you on the early notification list for the next bootcamp. If you have any questions about that, about the bootcamp or just in general, you can direct message me on Facebook or Instagram at Dr. Brian G. Brown, or simply go to my website, drbriangbrown.com/question, and click the button right there in the middle of the page and leave your question. I'll be glad to answer it. So tune in tomorrow at noon Eastern Standard Time for my In the Zone segment, where I'll be recapping today's interview with Maricela, showing you how the nuggets that she shared from this interview fit into the Genesis Zone Advantage. I'll be answering any questions. And again, as usual, I'll be exploring current event relevant topics related to peak performance and high achievement. Most informed, most trusted, and most grateful you spent this time with us today. Until next time, stay in the zone. I'm Dr. Brian Brown.